All right, everyone, on today's episode, we're going to discuss price-to-earnings ratio and how that might relate to an ESPP, employee stock purchase plan. And we're going to be doing this with Christy, who is one of the participants in our Households of FI case study series. And we were able to connect her to Brian Feraldi, friend of the FI community, and has come on the show many, many times to take a look at this approach to evaluating great companies, buying and holding for the long term. Welcome to the Ultimate Crowdsource Personal Finance Show. This is Choose FI.
You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
All right, guys, excited to dive into this case study. And to help me with this, I have my co-host Brad here with me today. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, Jonathan, I am doing quite well. Yeah, this is always nice to get an update on our Households of FI. So this is our third touch point with Chrissy. So she first appeared on episode 224. If anybody's looking to go back and listen to her whole story, she's a single mom with a daughter living in Minnesota. She was introduced to FI recently in the past year, as most of our Households of FI members are, as she was finishing her MBA. And, you know, she's just trying now to get on the path to FI. And I think she has a lot of questions about investing specifically. And that's kind of the next two episodes. So, right, she met with Big Earn from Early Retirement Now, obviously a huge favorite of ours here at Choose FI. So that was episode 259. And they had an in-depth conversation. And now we've connected her with Brian Feraldi. So she's getting some real superstars in the safe withdrawal and investing realm. So yeah, Jonathan, this should be good. And I guess they really, and we'll play this now, obviously, we'll talk about it on the backside, but they really dove into the ESPP, which will be applicable for a significant percentage of our audience, but certainly not the entire audience, but also price to earnings ratio. And how do you evaluate what a stock is actually worth? And I think for the vast majority of the audience, that's something that very few of us know, but we all should have at least a passing familiarity with it. So definitely excited to hear Brian talk about that and then you and I to dive into it.
All right. Well, with that, we'll go ahead and kick it off.
All right. Hello. I am Christy, and I'm part of the Choose FI Household series, and I am joined by Brian Feraldi, who has kind of been the voice on Choose FI for the benefits of individual stock investing. So thank you, Brian, for joining me and taking this time to do this coaching session with me today.
Yes, Christy, I am thrilled to be back in Choose FI. I love helping people in any way that I can, especially about things that excite me, and individual stock selection excites me.
Great. So I basically thought we could start the conversation around my employee stock purchase program. Currently, this is the only individual stock that I've invested in. It's kind of cheating. So I thought we could start there. A little bit of background about the program. So I'm able to buy my company stock for a 15% discount with up to 10% of my income. Mm-hmm. So I've kind of said this is my biggest financial mistake up to this point, because I have been purchasing that stock since I started my career, so over 6 years ago. And I have just only recently sold a lot of that stock. And so I've accumulated a lot of that, which is not great. Before finding kind of all of these financial independence topics, I did not know anything about investing, what a brokerage account was, or anything. So I definitely accumulated too much of that. So basically, in selling that first bit of stock, my thinking was that it would make sense to sell the stocks with the lowest cost basis and realize the largest gain. But I'm realizing maybe that's not the right strategy for tax purposes or other reasons. So maybe we can talk through your strategy around selling winners and losers, or how to best manage the cost basis piece?
Sure. So first and foremost, I'm not so much of a tax expert, but I can definitely offer some thoughts and opinions about it. And by the way, I really wish that my worst financial mistake was investing too much money into a great company such as 3M. So just let me make sure I fully wrap my head around this. A lot of companies that are publicly traded offer their employees the ability to have an employee stock purchase plan, ESPP, and that's what it seems like it has with you. Can you give me the real nitty-gritty details of this? So from what I understand, you can buy the stock at a 15% discount, and you can put up to 10% of your income in it. In regards to that 15% discount, how is that calculated? I've heard some cases when you put, let's say you put 10% of your income in, and then it buys it every 6 months, and whatever the closing price is at the end of the 6 months, that's the purchase price. I've also heard other plans where it's the 15% discount to the lowest trading price over that period. So give me the nitty-gritty details here.
So I'm not going to get probably all of the details right, but we purchase lots on a monthly basis. And I can't recall exactly what the purchase price is, if it's at the beginning of the month or at the end of the month when they actually purchase the stock. So I'm not positive about that, but it's on a monthly basis.
Gotcha. So if it's a monthly basis, my assumption would be at the end of every month, whenever it's like, okay, this is going to execute, it takes whatever the current share price is, subtracts 15%, and that's what your acquisition cost is. Are there any rules about how long you have to hold this for or anything like that?
Yeah, so we have to hold it for 2 years in order to get that favorable tax treatment.
And when you say favorable tax treatment, what do you mean by that?
So I believe how it works is the 15% discount is taxed as ordinary income.
Okay.
But then the capital gains are taxed as long-term gains if held for the 2 years.
Gotcha.
That makes sense?
Yes. So the difference between your purchase price and the 15% discount that you're getting, if you were to hold that for 2 years, that's not taxed as ordinary income?
I think the discount is still taxed as ordinary income.
Okay, it is, but there's a penalty to you in between that 15% if you sell within a 2 year period?
Right.
Okay, and obviously then there's just the regular tax benefit of if you hold this stock for more than a year, it qualifies as long-term capital gains as opposed to short-term capital gains. But either way, what you're doing with an employee stock purchase plan is you are putting, again, up to 10% of your income into a single stock. And that stock is also your employer, which means that your salary, your bonus, your retirement plan, any other benefits that you get, including all your career capital, is already tied up in that one company. So what you're saying is that I want to take all of that risk and put additional risk on top of that by putting 10% or whatever percent of my portfolio into that one company as well. That's just one thing to keep in mind with any stock purchase plan. Now, I would also factor in what company you work for. When I first started my career, I was with a company and just sheer luck, it went from the startup phase to the public market phase. And during that process, when they became publicly traded, they gave employees a similar employee stock purchase plan. I am a stock guy. I was bullish on the potential of the business, but I personally did not participate in the ESPP. That wasn't because I didn't think that the company had a bright future or anything like that. My entire logic was based around risk management. I said to myself, my career is here, my salary is here, my bonus is here, my health insurance here. I also got my car and my phone, as well as my stock options. All of that was already tied to the success of the business. Did I want to add even more to it? So my answer to that was no, I did not. That was enough risk for me. So I did not participate. I will tell you, the company that I worked for happened to be extremely successful. So I would be richer today if I did participate. But looking backwards, I'm still happy with my decision to do it because I wasn't making that decision to maximize my potential net worth. I was doing it to maximize my potential net worth while assuming as little risk as possible. So that's just one way that I personally think about this. So I just want to offer that to you. You already have a lot of your financial and career capital tied up in this business. Do you want more? Right. Do you want more risk tied to this business? That's a question that you have to answer.
Sure. Yep. That makes sense.
Now, having that in mind, 3M is an incredibly successful, incredibly well-diversified blue chip business. It's a low-risk company, and I completely understand why you want to take advantage of this, because in essence, they're giving you an immediate 15% return on your capital, assuming the share price doesn't change. That's what you're assuming, by the way. If it goes up, it's all upside. If it goes down, you still have a 15% buffer to work with. So as far as individual stock bets go, it's a pretty low risk one. But that is something that I would keep in mind. The other thing I'll say is ESPPs are great, but you also have to make sure you take care of all the other stuff before then. So right. Are you already maxing out your 401k?
Yes.
Are you already maxing out your IRAs?
Yes.
Have you paid off all your debts?
Other than my house.
Right. So do you have an emergency fund?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So great. You've taken care of the basics. And that to me is like table stakes before I would even consider something like an ESPP plan. So that's just what I'll encourage you to really think about. I think as far as businesses goes, 3M is incredibly stable. It's incredibly low risk, but you do have to always consider the pros and cons. You also mentioned that essentially 100% of your individual stock portfolio is in 3M?
Not 100% of it, but the majority of it. Yes, it's the only individual stock that I have invested in.
Okay. And on a scale of 1 to 10, how interested are you in learning about investing in individual stocks?
I would say like a 6.
Okay. So there is some interest there.
Yes.
Okay. With that in mind, it's important to know yourself. Lots of people have no interest in investing in individual stocks. And for those people, I say, you don't have to. You do not have to learn a thing about investing in individual stocks. That's why index funds exist. Index funds are wonderful, wonderful choices for the bulk of your capital. And I myself am a stock market junkie, and I also own index funds. All my retirement funds are just in index funds because it makes my life simple. So I would say, if you are a 6 out of 10, to me, there's nothing wrong with keeping the bulk of your assets and the bulk of your stock market investing in index funds. Mm-hmm. The bulk. Say, you pick the number, 80%, 90%, 70%, whatever. If you have an interest in individual stocks on top of that, then you can slowly layer in other stocks that meet your specific investing criteria. And by doing that, you are already incredibly well diversified by owning index funds. And then if you hold 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5 individual stocks with a small sliver of your portfolio, you can still feel really good about your long-term compounding chances. And you can be more concentrated into just a few stocks while still basically keeping diversification appropriate.
Okay, that all makes sense. Great.
Hey, this is Andrew from the Choose FI team. I hope you're enjoying the show. We're going to get right back to it after these quick messages.
So maybe we can talk about kind of how you would evaluate an individual stock, short-term or long-term. So we've talked about my company, and I looked up the PE ratio. I've heard you talk about this being an important factor when evaluating individual stocks. So maybe we can just talk a little bit about the implications of it in this specific example, which when I looked it up, it was 18.66. So maybe how this compares to the average and what the implications of that are.
Sure. So I'm glad you know about the PE ratio. The PE ratio is a tool that people can use to evaluate stocks. But like any tool, you have to know when it's appropriate to use and when it's not appropriate to use. You need to know its limitations and when it's a completely useless metric. So let's back up 1 second and just say, you would say, how do I approach investing in company in the short term and the long term? I will start with a short term question. I never invest in a company for the short term. And to me, the short term means less than 3 years. It is impossible to know what a stock is going to do in the short term. There are a bazillion factors that affect a company's share price or the stock market in general in the short term, and all of them are completely unpredictable. The only reason that stock prices in the stock market in general are predictable is because of what they can do in the long term. And the long term is always driven by earnings power and earnings growth, a change in a company's profitability. So let's just start there and say, I have no idea what 3M or any company is going to stock price is going to do in the short term? None. Zero. In my opinion, neither does anybody else. However, if 3M or any other business grows its profits over a 5 or 10 year period and continues to have a favorable outlook, then I would be comfortable in saying this company should increase in value as its profits increase in value. Now let's talk about the price to earnings ratio for a second. P stands for price, which means the price of one share. E stands for earnings, which is the net income or profits per share. The ratio between those two numbers tells you how much investors are willing to pay for $1 in profit of that company. So you mentioned that 3M's current price to earnings ratio is 18.66 or something like that. What that means is for every dollar in earnings power that 3M generates, the market is willing to pay 18 times that number, 18.6 times that number currently for earnings. If you flip that number around, it can be helpful to think about that on an earnings yields basis. So if we take 100 and divide by 18.66, if you think of it like an interest rate, that means that you're earning a 5.35% interest rate on 3M's earnings power. So that's like the inverse of the price to earnings ratio. Is that good? Is that bad? Well, like anything, context is key. Christy, can you see my screen here?
Yep.
Okay. This is a chart that shows the price to earnings ratio of 3M historically. So this is over the last 10 years. You can see that this number bounces around. It bounces up and down. In 2018, investors were willing to pay, looks like about 32 times earnings for 3M's earnings. And if you look at the 10-year low, that would be in 2012 or 2011. Investors were only willing to pay 12 times earnings for 3M's earnings power. This shows you how wildly different investors can be willing to pay on even a stable, predictable company like 3M. So currently, you would be paying about 18 and a half times earnings. Well, if you look historically compared to where this ratio has traded over the last 10 years, I would say that this is actually in the lower half of the price to earnings ratio of the company. Based on this, I would say that 3M's stock right now is more likely to be in bargain territory than it is to be in overly expensive territory. Now, if you're a buyer of 3M, you want to be buying when it's in bargain territory. If you're a seller of 3M, you want to be selling when it's in expensive territory. So this view can just help you to frame when it's better to be a buyer of a stock versus a seller of a stock. Now, this is just one metric, and one metric is often an incomplete amount of information because earnings can change drastically based on a number of factors. So I'm going to pull up the company's earnings and see how stable they are. So this is the company's net income over the last 10 years. So we can see, in general, it's pretty stable, but there are periods when earnings are spiked and then when earnings have fallen. And this just shows the limitations of just using the price to earnings ratio. What happened in 2018 that made their earnings fall? I don't know. It could have been something operational, or it could have been changes in their taxes, right? What caused their earnings to spike in 2019? I don't know. Was it a one-time sale of something, or was there short-term demand for one of their products? You kind of have to think about the normalized earnings power of a business. And if you can do that, the earnings is relatively smooth and up to the right. But again, going back to the PE ratio, notice that the price to earnings ratio jumped in 2018 because the earnings sank. Mm-hmm. So therefore, this number is probably artificially high. Conversely, earnings spiked in 2019, which makes the price to earnings ratio look artificially low. So I would try and keep these things in mind when you're trying to figure out what's a good value for the stock. And it just shows you, again, the limitations of only looking at something like the price to earnings ratio, you have to keep in mind, well, what happened to the earnings? Because occasionally this number can look out of whack, even for a big stable company such as 3M. So okay, that's how I would think about the price to earnings ratio of this business. One other metric I will throw out there, and am I going too fast?
No, this is great. Thank you.
Okay. Another metric that you can look at, which is again, something that a metric that I always look at, but again, has limitations, is the price to sales ratio. So this figure is the price of the business divided by the sales, just the revenue per share. The reason that this metric can be useful is it eliminates all of the factors that can cause earnings to be one-time swing up and down, and revenue tends to be a much more stable number. Again, it's an imperfect metric, just like every metric is completely imperfect, but we can see at least that judging by the last 10 years, in 2018, investors were paying 5x sales for 3M. In 2012, they were paying less than 2x sales for 3M. Currently, they're paying about 3x sales. Based on that, I would once again argue the odds are pretty good that 3M right now, based on its historic trading ranges, is more likely to be in the buy territory than it would be in the candidate for, boy, is it time to lighten territory. Okay. The tool that I use to find these is called YCharts. It's a wonderful tool. It is a paid product. There is another company out there called StockRow. I'll put a link to that in the chat. And you can see all of these metrics in a similar way. But these are the kind of things you need to think about and consider when you're interested in scaling in or scaling out of a business that's relatively predictable like 3M.
Okay, great. That's very helpful. And those resources look fantastic. I've only really gotten into like looking at Yahoo Finance, which is very likely not the best tool out there. And some of the things on Yahoo Finance are like the upgrades and downgrades of the analysts, the average price target stuff. This stuff kind of paints a scary picture a lot of the time, I feel like. But I'm assuming that is kind of the short-term viewpoint of Wall Street.
Yes.
Rather than the long-term things that we should be looking at, like you just discussed.
Exactly. Wall Street operates on a different cycle than individual investors.
All right. Well, huge thanks to Brian for coming on the show and also to Christy for really, being able to share kind of what it is that she's working through. It actually went in two very distinct directions, both of which are valuable for different subsets of the community. And I wanted to point out that back in episode 259, so choosify.com/259, she did talk to Big Earn in a lot more depth about the employee stock purchase plan. And Big Earn wrote a fantastic article that we will have linked up in the show notes as well. The one thing that to me stands out about the employee stock purchase plan, this is kind of my big takeaway, assuming that your company is a good company, generally a good company. Brian and her are rightly identified, like you already have a lot tied up in this company. You have your job, your 401k, you have, they're just so, you already have a lot of risk tied up in this company. How much more of your investments do you want to have tied up as well? And I think the balancing act there was really looking at the interplay between when do you switch over? And I don't think they nailed this directly on this conversation, but I just want to point out to people, and you'll get all of this in Big Earn's article if you were to click on the link below or go check out his website for it. When does it switch over from short-term capital gains to long-term capital gains, which dramatically will impact your tax bracket that you find yourself in when you transition out? And then two, what is the interplay? And they did not hit this as much as they could have, which is totally fine. I wanted to come back now on this. You need to look with your employee stock purchase plan. Most of them do have some sort of a minimum holding period. And they loosely address this, but with some companies, it might be 6 months. With others, it might be a year. Maybe it's much as 2 years. You really want to look at what that is and then trying to find that sweet spot between when you're outside that minimum holding period and then when you're outside of the short-term capital gains and you move to long-term capital gains. When you're inside that, that's how you're getting the sweet spot. And then all the other factors about the unique nuances of your employee stock purchase plan. Did they, at the end of the 6 month, look at the lowest, price over that 6 month period and then take an additional 15% off? There's unique characteristics to all of these, but these are the types of questions to actually look at. And I think if you actually went back to one of our early episodes where someone was talking about how to hack your ESPP, they were basically saying, yes, participate, definitely participate, but to the point of mitigating risk, you know, once you're out of the minimum holding period and you've moved into long-term capital gains, take that discount that you've locked in and roll it over and move it to something that's potentially outside that company. So, Brad, those are kind of like my big takeaways on the ESPP part. Did you have anything you would add to that? Maybe in particular, I'm thinking about the difference between short-term capital gains and long-term capital gains for listeners.
Yeah. And just a quick note, that episode that you referenced from way back when was actually episode 24R.
Still relevant. So
Yeah, still very relevant. How to hack your ESPP. So yeah, good memory on that. Yeah, I think in very general terms, so long-term capital gains. I think this is something that's important that everybody understands this. I'm talking now more broadly here, just owning stocks or mutual funds generally. So outside of the ESPP, but it's really critical that we understand there are preferential tax rates for long-term capital gains, okay? And the line of delineation for short and long is actually 1 year. So it's really not all that long in the cosmic scheme of things, but it's just important that, you know, if you make a sale, and now when we're talking about capital gains, so let's say for argument's sake, you bought one share of a mutual fund at $100, okay? And it goes up to $110, let's say. And you have then a built-in gain. You have an unrealized gain because you haven't realized it by selling it. So of that $10, so just the current market price of $110, less your basis, your purchase price of $100. Okay. So the difference is that 10 bucks. That's a gain that you theoretically, when you realize it, when you sell that mutual fund, you will have to pay some type of tax on the capital gain that you've earned there. Now, if you happen to buy and sell that one mutual fund, that one share of that mutual fund in under a year, then that would be a short-term capital gain. And that $10 of gain would all be treated on your tax return as if it were ordinary income, as if it was wages that you earned at your W-2 job, okay? So it gets no preferential tax treatment. So whatever your marginal tax rate is, it gets included in that normal calculation. Whereas if you held it for 1 year and a day and sold it, then that same $10 capital gain, actually, let's take a quick step back. So the top marginal bracket for most people, you're going to be in somewhere in the 20s, you know, 22, 24%, somewhere around that. So that $10 of gain, let's say, would be taxed at 24%, just hypothetically. So it's $2.40 of tax you're paying. Now, obviously, in this hypothetical, I set up these tiny little numbers, so it doesn't sound like too much, right? But
we could be talking about, you know, $100,000, or we could, right. Or even the gain could be $50,000 or $60,000. I mean, this could be, it's percentages. It works for tiny amounts of money. It works for very big amounts of money. The principle is the key here.
Exactly. And you can see I'm coming up with this hypothetical on the fly here, and I would have used a bigger number, obviously. But yes, the principle is the key. Because, right, many of us, when we have huge savings rates and we're saving over a long period of time, these are going to be big numbers, right? They're going to be tens of thousands of dollars of gain, if not more. And we need to consider this because this will be a massive difference. So with long-term capital gains, you get better tax treatment if you hold it for, again, that year or longer. So for most people currently, the long-term capital gains tax rate is going to be 15%. So instead of, in this admittedly stupid example, instead of paying $2.40, you'd pay $1.50, right? So, I mean, that on a percentage basis is massive, right? That's a 9% difference. Now, multiply that by thousands, and I mean, you're talking real money. So for most of us, the difference between short-term cap gains and long-term cap gains is massive. And even still, there's even ways that you can get it at a lower capital gains rate than that. You know, that's kind of outside the bounds of this. But for the vast majority of us, 15% is the cap gains tax rate you'll pay on long-term sales.
Perfect. Okay, so that is just the points of consideration. I think for those of you that have access to an ESPP, it's going to be something you're going to research. It is part of your compensation. And, you know, so for some people that it feels like there's some friction to setting it up, so they don't really research it. But a lot of companies, especially in the S&P 500, have some sort of employee stock purchase plan. I know with the corporation that I worked for, they sure did. So kind of knowing how this works could be a way for you to potentially, you know, get effectively a raise. If you're not leveraging this now, it could be several thousand dollars a year. I mean, that's the implications of compensation that maybe you're leaving on the table by not looking at this. But then they did a great job, I think, really pointing out that your goal here is not to build all of your wealth with the company that you're currently working for. There's so much risk inherent in that. Your job is already tied up in them. Why would you want your retirement and everything else to be if you could have the flexibility to get into something where you have a little bit more control over it? So that's kind of where that rule-based structure, and that's where they went. But then the next piece of that is, well, how, you know, stable or good is my company? How do I value my company? And that's really where part two of this conversation becomes so valuable. And it's one that scales out to just individual stock investors generally. What does it mean when you hear someone say that a company is overvalued or overbought? What does that mean? You know, oh, just a lot of people are buying it. The price is going up. No, that doesn't get us there. You know, the price going up doesn't have anything to do with it being overvalued or overbought. They could be correlated, but not necessarily. So really, Brian, with this, was able to give us a wonderful way to actually analyze that statement and find out the value of your company if we're looking at it through the lens of an ESPP, but really more importantly for those of us that don't, how to value any company. When we're talking about Tesla, when we're talking about Facebook, when we're talking about Microsoft, when we're talking about maybe, you know, some of these companies that have just absolutely crushed it, is there a way that we could start to think about things in terms of apples to apples and make comparisons between this company being a great value and that company, even though it's done really well over the last year, maybe not being a good value? And Brad, I'll kind of give this to you, just to your thoughts on that. The price to earnings ratio seems like a phenomenal place to start.
Yeah, agreed. And that's exactly, I think, what Brian was intimating. He said PE ratio is a tool, right? He very specifically said it is a tool, and it's probably a pretty good starting point. But of course, just like any tool, it has its limitations. But I think for like a mental model, I think it's a good idea for us to understand this, right? To understand conceptually what we're talking about here, because you hear this stuff thrown around all the time. Jonathan, to your point about companies that seem to have these crazy valuations based on their earnings, you know, a la Tesla. Now, there's so much more that goes into a lot of this stuff, right? I mean, there's the narrative, there's the new technology, there's the potential, right? Like, I mean, humans are, we're interesting animals with interesting brains, right? We can derive a narrative out of almost anything. So sometimes the true fundamentals, that's not what's driving the stock price. And you have to understand that, and you have to understand where this fits in. I think for certain more established businesses, you know, I guess they were talking about 3M in this particular case, maybe price earnings ratio is a more effective tool. Because, you know, there's some stability. You can look at history. That was kind of another thing that Brian talked about. He was actually talking about it in terms of as a multiple of sales. But the same holds true for price earnings, right? Which is, okay, this company has been moving along for decades. There's stability. There's nothing crazy. There's no bizarre new technology that, you know, people might value at many, many multiples, et cetera, et cetera. And you can look at where has this been previously. And yeah, Jonathan, just a quick overview of price earnings ratio. Actually, Brian Feraldi did an amazing job on episode 200 when he was on. He actually gave us this example of a lemonade stand. So he kind of asked you and I hypothetically, like, okay, he owns a lemonade stand that makes $1,000 a year and he wants to sell it. How much would we pay? All right. And he said, Jonathan, if you were willing to pay only $1,000, then you take the price, the sales price of $1,000. And divide it by that annual earnings to get your PE ratio, okay? So in that case, it's just one, right? Very simply, 1,000 divided by 1,000 is one. And you'd be making 100% profit every year, which is pretty darn good. But let's say I was willing to pay $10,000. So the price is 10,000, the earnings are 1,000. So you take 10,000 divided by 1,000 and the PE ratio is 10. And also then you're saying, okay, I paid in $10,000 and I'm earning 1,000 on that every year. So that's a 10% return. That's another cool way to look at this, right? So you can back into, and that's what he was saying in this episode with Christy, with 3M saying, let's say they had an 18.6%, I think it was, PE ratio. If you take 100 and divide it by that PE ratio, you get that return. So in this case, it's just 100 divided by 18.6, and that comes out to about 5.4%. Okay. So like, to me, those are two kind of cool ways to look at this. Like, hey, what's my anticipated return? If I was the sole owner of this business, what would be my anticipated return? Because I just plunked down all this money, you know, to buy 3M, it would be billions and billions of dollars. I just plunked down billions of dollars and it's earning me this amount. Hey, I'm getting about a 5.37% return on that. Okay. That's not bad. You know, we're on this lemonade stand. I'm getting a 10% return on that. That's not too shabby at all. Right. So it's kind of cool. That's the interplay here of this price to earnings ratio. And then I guess kind of the inverse, I'm not sure if that would even be the technical math term, but is, you know, what is the return that I'm getting on this? So I guess to me, Jonathan, that's kind of the setup that we all should consider of like, hey, if I'm the sole owner of this, what am I getting? So yeah, pretty cool little framework of something that might sound a little esoteric when you hear it, the price earnings ratio. You know, you hear these numbers thrown out, but like, what the heck does that actually mean? Well, this is what it means. You know, I just bought a lemonade stand. It's spitting off this amount of money. This is my price to earnings ratio.
So for those of you that want to do this on your own, he did mention a paid tool, Y-Charts. Brad, did he have a free option that he mentioned as well? That was some limited functionality. I'm just thinking, what if someone wants to go do the experiment on their own ESPP? Was there a free tool that they could find their own price to earnings ratio with?
Yeah, I didn't jot it down if he did mention it, but we'll follow up with Brian and see if he did, we'll put it in the show notes for sure.
All right, everyone. Well, there is your breakdown for you. Thanks for tuning in today. And if you want more, you know, financial independence related content, make sure you lock it in and subscribe. And if you are just now getting started on your own path to financial independence, let me encourage you, get started with us. Go to chooseify.com/start. We've put all of our resources there for you in one place, including an option to take a 5-day challenge, just to kind of give you a sense for the basic tenets of financial independence, the things that you need to lock down to map out your own path to financial independence. All right, my friends, the fire is spreading. We'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.
If this episode was helpful to you, don't forget to subscribe. If you want to help spread the word, please give us a 5-star review and tell your friends about us. We can be found on Apple, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere you listen to podcasts. While you're there, don't forget to check out our other shows like Everyday Courage with Julian Johnsrud and Rebel Entrepreneur with Alan Dalmagan. If you would like a free bite-sized course to jumpstart your financial independence, check out chooseify.com/challenge. Chooseify is produced by Andrew Mendonza and Zachary Tan and is a production of Chooseify Media Incorporated. Chooseify.com is managed by Annie Sheely with William McVeigh, MK Williams, Melissa Lagerquist, Liz Kessler, Stephen Heptig, Kelly Black, and Jennifer Ma. And Ed T is our CEO. Thanks for listening.